Chapter 42
"We have a problem," Con Arthur said as his skimmer bumped ashore on the little island where Kip and the Mighty had camped. "I'll explain as we go."
Kip and Kruxer helped push off and jumped aboard. The Mighty's skimmer would follow. They were off instantly, if clumsily. The ghosts were still figuring out the skimmers. Con Arthur said,
"There was a red white yesterday who escaped our clash at the warehouse. Distinctive? No skin on his forearms. Several other whites and soldiers escaped as well, of course. But him? Him we recognized. Name's Beath. He's a former novice of Shady Grove who left us years ago. It was not an amicable parting. His gifts lay elsewhere. Clearly he's been exploring those gifts, and now he's found a home for them with the blood robes. Trouble is, he recognized us. One of our scouts caught sight of him last night. He was carrying some scroll cases. We think he's heading back to the main army to report everything that happened here, both above and below the falls. And, of course, who we are. Regardless, we get those papers and we get some idea of what they know," he grunted, and it sounded like a bear huffing as it tore apart a fallen log looking for grubs.
"And you want to go after him?" Kip guessed.
"One of our women who grew up here said she knows a river valley he'll have to pass through tonight. It's narrow enough we can be sure he won't slip through our fingers there. After that, he's gone. We don't know exactly where the White King's army is, and there are many paths available to him, most of them not on the river. These skimmers are our biggest advantage right now. Here's our chance to use their speed."
Kip looked to Kruxer for his take.
"Anything we can do to minimize what the Blood Robes know about us," the young commander said.
"Can we go after him and still get back to Fecheen Island the day after tomorrow?" Kip asked. He promised to meet the Cooney War there.
"It'll involve some backtracking, but with the skimmers, not a problem," Con Arthur said.
So they skimmed up the wide river for a few hours. Kip noticed that one of the ghosts with the Con, a newly established bodyguard, had a white spear etched with many yellowing runes. The leaf blade of the spear was hellstone. "That a Sharanaru spear?" Kip asked. The young man looked immensely pleased. "My great-great-grandfather was given it from the land of Z. Oakenshield. He liked to say he should have changed history with his spear. He coated the blade with poison before the battle, and during it he stabbed Darien Gyle in the arm. But it turned out the wise man who'd mixed the poison was a charlatan. Gave Darien nothing more than an itch for 3 days. Later my father served in Darien Gyle and Selene Oakenshield's household. Grandpa Sheh said he was worried he'd be killed for that scratch when his betters made their peace and married. But the Gyle laughed about it with him instead. Kept Grandpa Sheh close for many years. Even came when my great-great-grandfather was on his deathbed and laughed with him about it one last time. Great man, Darien Gyle. Wish our family could have stayed with yours through the blood wars, my lord." There had been so many back and forths in that interminable conflict that Kip wasn't even sure when the houses might have been pulled apart. "Well, the good news is that we're on the same side again," Kip said. "What's your name?"
"Garrett, sir."
"Well, Garrett, if you ever want a rapt audience who will ask you a million questions about that spear, talk to Ben Haydad. In fact, if you don't want to talk about it, you'll probably have to hide." Just then there was a shout as one of the Con's skimmers blew off one of its reeds. Half an hour later, ashore, Ben Haydad hobbled over on one crutch and reported,
"Repair shouldn't take more than an hour."
He was taking the failure personally. Kip didn't blame him. There was simply no way to expect reliable drafting out of amateurs. He blamed the masters of Shady Grove. What the hell kind of drafters went their lives without drafting? Sure, you'd live for 70 years instead of 40 or 50, but a drafter was a candle. She was made to bring light and be consumed in the process. These were candles who lived and died having barely touched a flame. To one who'd always heard that drafters were given their powers and privileges for their community's betterment, it seemed astoundingly selfish. Still, in purely utilitarian terms, it did give him more of their drafting lives to use if he could teach them quickly enough to keep them from getting killed. Kip didn't want to split up the platoon if he could help it, so he consulted with the woman who knew the valley Beath would pass through, and decided they could lose 2 hours without losing their chance to catch it. Ben had asked for one. "You have an hour and a half," he told Ben Haydad. "Everything always takes longer than you think it will." In the meantime, as the others kindled a fire and made lunch and checked their own skimmers for damage, Kip memorized maps and made plans for where they would beach the skimmers, who would stay with them, and how the rest would spread out through the woods. The ghosts would look for tracks to find the Red White's trail if he was ahead. If they'd passed him, they would prepare an ambush point. Otherwise, they would wait until after dark when he could no longer draft and set upon him at his camp. Baith was a Red, so Kip figured the White would light a campfire to give himself a source. It would make him much easier to find. "You're confident in your trackers?" Kip asked the Con. The Con nodded.
"Not that I wouldn't mind having me a Daiwan Web."
"Daiwan Web?" Kip asked. There was an odd buzzing low in his ears at the name.
"Young man, scary. Way over on the other side of Greenhaven last I heard, though. In the old tongue, they call him Shelgeir na Skian."
"He who hunts with knives?" Tysis asked. Con Arthur said,
"I know it doesn't sound very imposing, but..."
But it hit Kip between the eyes. Everything disappeared in a rush of leaves. The next thing he was aware of, he was lying on the ground, blinking at concerned faces ringing him.
"Oh, Hollum's hair is breaking. You almost fell in the fire," Farcudi said. "If Big Leo hadn't grabbed you..."
"Does he have the falling sickness?"
Con Arthur asked Tysis.
"Stop," Kip said. "Silence, please."
He reached after memories that were fading like a scent in the wind. A scent. That was it. Something burning. No, something that had been burning. Kip opened his eyes and grabbed a stick from the fire. He stubbed it out on the ground and walked away, wafting the smoking wood in front of him, concentrating. As with the first link of a chain, the rest came as he pulled on that. The smell, the memory, was from a burning village. He blinked, blinked again. He went back to the fire to stand next to Tysis. He murmured in her ear, "Was I gone for long just now?" "What?" she asked. "No, a few heartbeats." "Oh, good."
"I'm sorry, but I must ask," Con Arthur said. "Are you ill? More to the point, are you too ill to lead us?"
"No and no," Kip said. "It was momentary. I'm better now. I must have eaten something that disagreed with me last night." Winston cleared his throat behind his fist.
"Didn't sound like she disagreed much."
The rest of the mighty cracked up. "Hey," Kip said. In a falsetto, as if in the throes of passion, Big Leo went, "Ah, ah." Kip's silver tongue failed him. He glanced at Tysis. Her colour was high, but she shot back at Big Leo immediately.
"Oh, you think that was me?"
She looked over at Kip significantly. They burst out laughing.
"Ah, ah,"
Big Leo said, somehow managing to append a question mark to his falsetto while giving Kip the side eye. Kip nodded, taking his lumps. "Fine, fine, I'll practice making acceptably manly ejaculations nightly while you boys get to cuddle with each other."
"Ooh,"
Big Leo said. "That's low, brother," Winston said. "Did Ferk tell you how Big Leo threw his arm over me last night?"
"No," Tysis said. "What happened? I couldn't get away. He wouldn't wake up."
"A guy gets lonely,"
Big Leo said defensively.
"I need a new tent, mate," Winston said. "Ferk, I know you snore, but I can deal."
"That wasn't snoring," Cruxus said. "I do not know what it is. We all eat the same food, but this man's anus. If we could weaponize his farts..." "Those were farts,"
Big Leo said.
"I thought we were being shot at. They woke me up like 6 times.
"Wait, you woke up 6 times? So you were awake," Winston said. "Why didn't you let go of me?"
"Oh, come on," Farcudi said. "Maybe I fart a bit more than some of you, but at least mine don't stink."
"Ferk," Tysis said, "I smelled you from our tent 50 paces away."
"Now you're just piling on," Farcudi said. "Go on, have your fun. But I don't know why I always end up being the..."
He trailed off as it dawned on him.
"Wait, I really am the butt of the mighty, aren't I? This is my destiny."
"Why don't you all go check with Ben-Hadad if he needs anything?" Kip said.
He just noticed that Con Arthur hadn't said a word in several minutes, since they started joking. Kip had been distracted by his friends, but the man stood like a bear on its hind legs, staring at you, uncertain whether to plop down on all fours and amble away or to charge you with sudden fury. Tysis left last, giving him a kiss on the cheek and saying,
"I'm sorry, that was wicked of me. You'll have to punish me later."
"Right, as if I'd punish you for..."
Kip trailed off. "That was me missing the point, wasn't it?" She winked at him and left, leaving Kip with the glowering giant. As Kip studied him, though, he looked less angry and disapproving and more bereft. This was a man to whom joy was only a memory. When he finally spoke, the Khan said,
"Congratulations on your nuptials."
"Thank you."
"We're away from safe territory now. I think you pitching your tent away from the camp is a bad idea. You should be in the center of camp. You and your bride can carry on as you will. Our people aren't shy about such things."
"Right," Kip said lamely. He'd thought the big man's comments were going to be about something else entirely.
"Shabeel was deeply impressed by what she witnessed last night."
"She was," Kip said.
"But I see that you're still pretty young, too."
It stung, of course, being slapped down by a big, imposing older man. He was partly right, too. Sex jokes with his buddies? Or were they his buddies? Shouldn't they be his men? Shouldn't he, their leader, demand more respect? The old Kip would have sucked that insult into his big old blubbery ego and gnawed on it, cracking apart bone and marrow of the insult and eventually returning with his own mind made up. That, Kip, hadn't been all wrong, because the opposite approach would be to attack Con Ruachan Arthur in return, as any young blowhard would. "You're not wrong," Kip said, "but tell me, where's saying that aloud to me come from? You're a quiet man and not stupid. Was that a test? Or was it a friendly warning that your people distrust me because of my youth already and I should be careful? Or did it come from some bitterness at our camaraderie?" The Khan looked at Kip through tight blue eyes. He stroked his red, red beard.
"It was a test. I didn't have it all laid out sly-like. Just had a thought and wanted to see if you'd lose your temper if I said it to your face," he said. "I don't know what kind of man you are, Kip Guile, but you make me nervous. You led us to a great victory at Dora Neve. Maybe a small victory in size, but strategically important and flawlessly planned, and you did it immediately after we joined you, which inspires us. How'd you do that?"
"I've read some books," Kip said. Truth was, he had read Corvin's books, but not like 50 of them, maybe 4. What he'd done at Dora Neve wasn't exactly forging new military doctrine. A diversionary raid was pretty basic, and though he'd never read about anyone's using superviolet flares for communication, he surely couldn't be the first to come up with it. But he'd also absorbed a lot of cards, a lot of memories. Surely among them must be some of the greatest tacticians of all time. Kip knew he should feel worried about the dead men in his head. Except they weren't like invaders. The memories sat on one shelf in the library of his mind, and he knew which memories were his and which were not. He felt no more threatened by those memories than by a vivid book. Well, usually. Suddenly passing out because he'd stepped through an unseen tripwire of Daiwen Webb's memories was unnerving, and could maybe be dangerous if it happened in the middle of battle or something, but mostly it just was. For once, he didn't overthink it. If he could find a tactician in his head and plunder that man's thinking in order to save his life and his friends, to Kip that didn't feel any different from studying General Corvin Danovis's tactics during the False Prisms War. Sure, it felt a little strange to scrutinize someone close to you by the same standards you applied to the greats of history, but you got over it.
"You read some books," Con Arthur said flatly.
"Father Violet himself said he learned all he knew of fighting from books, and that he fought his last battle by the same tactics he'd used to win his first. The art isn't knowing what to do, it's knowing exactly what your people can do, and getting them to do it at the right time. I haven't been tested on those parts at all."
"So, despite our effortless victory, you're worried you don't know what you're doing?"
"We got lucky, and I'm worried it won't scale, that my skills won't grow as quickly as our army does." The Khan snorted.
"That's what you're afraid of?"
"Why's that funny?" Kip asked.
"Because it hasn't even occurred to you to be afraid that no one will join you. I can't tell if your total expectation of success is a function of your youth and inexperience, or insanity, or a deserved confidence. Oddest of all, I'm not sure it matters at this point."
"But," Kip said.
"But it will matter later," Con Arthur said.
He seemed as if he wasn't sure he wanted to say it. He wasn't trying to make Kip angry now. He was deeply worried.
"Someday we'll face the White King himself or one of his generals, and I don't want that day to be the day we find out it really was madness or youth all along."
"That's a lot of anxiety for you to tie up around some puerile jokes," Kip said.
"It's not just the contents of the jokes. It's that you're joking. You're enjoying yourself out here,"
Con Arthur said. "I was," Kip said lightly. But the Con's point sank deep. Perhaps the hairy bear of a man mistook how quickly Kip could shift from jokey to thoughtful, though. The Khan said in a way that made it clear he was quoting someone,
"A man who loves war will be feared by his foes. He should be feared by his friends."
Kip had been careless. Con Arthur looked like a badass warrior. He would, if he lived long enough, probably become one, but he'd probably never fought until yesterday. The man was shaken. He didn't understand what it does to you to see a pile of fresh heads stacked in a pyramid, what it meant to find half your friend's leg lying on your pack, or to laugh as a musket ball snapped past your ear, because hearing that snap meant they'd missed. He hadn't seen how precious any laughter at all is, because sometimes at the campfire, a laugh was the only thing that kept you from thinking too hard about that thing you'd seen or that thing you'd done. But Kip had been careless. Part of a warrior's duty was to remember what it had been to be a civilian, to protect that innocence and not sneer at it. Kip recognized the quote. "Aristophanes, Tactics, the fourth scroll, if I recall correctly." The Khan shook his head. He didn't know where it was from. "It's from the conclusion in the sixth scroll, actually," Kip said. "You pass. I'm glad to see you're not a man who pretends to know what he doesn't, at least in some things."
"You're testing me now," Con Arthur said.
"Have you heard the quote from Veliki Eden? It is well that war is so terrible, or we should grow too fond of it." Do you think he was kidding?
"I've heard it," the Con said. "I've always taken that to mean that to their sorrow men are fools ever rushing to arms.
I take it different. War is hell, but hell's where all my friends are." Con Arthur looked pensive.
"Time will tell which of us is right. Perhaps both. I only hope for us all that your knowledge becomes wisdom painlessly. Your pardon, Lord Guile."
Kip nodded, surprised that the man would ask to be dismissed. But before he had gone far, the Con stopped and turned back.
"One last thing. As I said, my people aren't shy about matters of the root and cave, but a little consideration for those trying to sleep nearby does go a long way."
"Right," Kip said. "Root and cave? Oh. Right." When the hour and a half had passed, Ben Haydad hadn't yet fixed the first skimmer, and he'd also found other potentially catastrophic cracks on three of the other skimmers. Kip elected to leave them behind and headed out with only four skimmers loaded with the best fighters. Tisis stayed behind. She said, "I'm more used to you as an ear and tongue than as another gun." She looked momentarily perplexed. Not that that was supposed to rhyme. "Such things occur from time to time." "Very funny. You're such a tease," she said. "You know I always aim to please." He frowned. "What the hell?" "I know that's the kind of silly thing I do," Kip said, "but I swear I didn't intend to." He blinked. "That also wasn't my intent." "It's fine, my dear. I know what you—" She seemed to struggle to form a different word. Then in defeat, she said, "meant." "Kip, what's going on?" "I don't know, but the effect is strong. Let super violet," she said. It seemed the first line could be anything, but as if in some inescapable chain of cause to effect, it was impossible not to follow it with a rhyming couplet. Slant rhymes worked. How about if you ended a line with a word that didn't have a rhyme? Oh, super violet. She hadn't simply meant a rhyme with let. She meant he needed to look at super violet. He narrowed his eyes to the superviolet spectrum and saw the colour storm whipping past them in ordered violence. Like a mechanical octopus, every arm articulated with a million hinges, the storm swept the camp, but each segment of the arm moved only in right angles. Kip handed his superviolet lenses to Tisis so she could see it too. A few people were looking up around the camp, quizzical looks on their faces. Of those who were moving about, they too were moving only in the same straight lines. The superviolet was everywhere. And then, before he could even say anything, it was gone. "Are you okay?" Tisis asked. "Why?" he asked. "Because it all swirled around you in a weird funnel cloud before it disappeared." "It did?" He'd thought it was everywhere, but then, if he had been in the middle of a cloud of it, he would have. "It was like it was looking for you. And it found me."